Hello and welcome to I Am The Egg Pods with me, Chris Shaw. Throughout January 2022, a potpourri of delicious guests are taking a jaunty stroll through Peter Jackson's Get Back, day by day, every day, on the day. In this episode, it's a welcome return to comedy writer Joel Morris. Hello.
Hello.
You.
This is a nice thing to do.
It is. You're one of the reasons I'm doing it. You contacted me. You said, basically, if you don't do it, I'm going to do it. So I had to do it.
I've made you do a thing I couldn't be bothered to do. That's brilliant. I'm really glad. Well, actually, it should be. It's completely Egg Pod. It's just so Egg Pod's wheelhouse. This is exactly what Egg Pod should be doing.
So we're talking about day two. And yesterday, previous day, well, first day, didn't go too badly. There are a few concerns about Twickenham Studios. No one could really decide where to do the shows, but Michael Lindsay-Hogg had a pretty good idea. But I'm sure everything will be resolved very quickly today. So we start with Paul, and I'm pretty sure it's the David Frost theme he's playing that he did at the beginning of Hey Jude.
Well, they did David Frost in September 68. I keep forgetting this is January 69. So everything you think of as Beatles 68 is about 5 minutes beforehand. It's not like it's the middle of 1969. So I think it's September they do Hey Jude on David Frost, and he goes, the world's greatest tea room orchestra, that shit, before doing Hey Jude. And obviously this is the last thing they probably played together. So the last time they were together as a band probably was doing stuff like this. So this is weirdly, it's a nice clue as to where the Beatles are. And the Beatles are amazingly rusty. They've not played together for ages. So when they get together and sit down, they play the one thing they have rehearsed, which is the David Frost theme.
Their last live performance.
That's what they've got. They've got the chops to really knock out a decent version of the David Frost theme. And it's kind of telling to you, go, I think, rewatching this again, I'd watched Get Back in a massive binge and then watched this one again and went, oh, at this point, the thing it's about is the band being rusty. It's a rusty band and they're trying to do something very difficult for a rusty band.
Mm. And again, the complaints about yesterday, about the drabness of Twickenham, they've got coloured lights which have been installed, and they do make a difference.
Yeah, it's odd because they're in an empty space, and it does say something interesting about how where the world is of this kind of art. As in, this is the post White Album's out 6 weeks earlier, so the White Album has said blank space. Now the White Album should have had a cover that said A Doll's House, should have been Busy. But it doesn't. It says the new aesthetic in rock is the opposite of psychedelia, the opposite of Sgt. Pepper. It's just emptiness. And here they are kind of performing inside the White Album cover. There's nothing there. And it's really uninspirational. It's a really uninspirational space to do it. But also, it's saying stripped back and really minimal. But I think this is what my real impression of this day particularly is, they're discussing and finding the limits of what they thought would probably be quite a straightforward project, which is, let's get together and play again. Let's play together again, because the White Album, they were all separate. Let's all get them and play again. But it's really hard for a band who haven't played together, apart from the David Frost theme, to get back together and then hit a groove in an empty space with nothing to inspire them. And I think what you're watching is what seemed like a really easy ask. Macca says, let's be the band we used to be. It turns out to be a really hard ask.
Yeah, I love the minutiae. George is flicking through the January 69 issue of the Beatles Monthly, which is lovely because I used to get the reprints of that.
Yeah.
And it's weird to see them reading what I was reading as a kid.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing as well, especially because of what this project is now to us in 2021, 2022, which is, this is the Beatles reconsuming their own myth. So their myth is still being put out there, and they're having a little wry smile at how they're being projected. And yet this project is yet another chance for them to revisit another version of their myth, the retelling that Michael Lindsay-Hogg attempted in 1970. They're trying it, 69-70. They've revisited it again, and it's kind of, this is all about how we consume and reconsume this myth all the time. And weirdly, the Beatles book always looked like it was from 1963, even when it was 1969, the graphics and things. That kind of Paul stepping out with his new girlfriend vibe is still there, even though they now look like 70s rockers. It's great.
Yeah. And they kind of mention that themselves, don't they? They're saying, you know, it's everything's so jolly and 63 in this magazine. Like, even if we went to prison. Like, yeah. You know, here's Ringo in the mailroom.
Yeah, it's kind of a comment on people's suspicions about what Peter Jackson was going to do. Is that, was he going to lie about the Beatles being in a good mood during a period when they're seeing them in a bad mood? Is kind of that thing. Is he going to Beatlify? Is he going to make a Hard Day's Night. Hard Day's Night's a fairly gritty, I suppose. But like a cinematic version. Is he going to turn them into the Beatles cartoon characters, the cartoon series? Is he going to make them into wacky sort of dandy characters? And they're sort of enjoying the fact that they exist in both those worlds, that they're real people. This is a fly on the wall documentary. But they're owned by the public. They are cartoon characters as well.
Yeah. And another little moment I really enjoyed was George is there, and he says to Paul, yeah, the beard really suits you, man. And again, it's that sort of, that's what I've been saying for years.
That's lovely, isn't it? Yeah. Well, it's nice as well, because they're really, this is a very friendly, I mean, I grew up watching Let It Be on a horrible, ropey old VHS as a sort of teenage Beatles nerd. Someone had taped it off a tape when it was on BBC Two. And I watched that, and it was miserable. And Twickenham especially was cold and miserable. What's really nice with a bit more space to see some more angles of it is that they are all really friendly. They're really in a good mood with each other. And actually, the real revelation here is George, who on day two, according to this edit, is kind of the leader of the band. Mm. He's the one asking serious questions and being friendly, keeping everyone together, talking about the difference between studio recording and live, talking about what the new record could be, how it could be, talking about sounds. He's really engaged. He's basically Macca, which you don't see in Let It Be at all. You just see this miserable guy. The shift from this to where he's going to be in a few days is set up on this day to go, he's completely up for this and interested and engaged and has got lots of opinions, has brought lots of songs, and it's going to be disillusionment you're going to watch from now on. But he's really engaged and really friendly, and he loves being with his mates, and Ringo starts playing his song and George joins in and he wants to help everybody. He's on lovely form on day two.
Taking a trip to Carolina. And it's yet another,
it's adorably
another nautical Ringo song. Taking a trip on an ocean liner.
Ringo's got... He's always on the water, isn't he? He comes from a port city and you can tell. No, it's lovely. Yeah. And what's lovely about it is he presents it with the confidence of everyone presenting their song to a band, which is he loses confidence almost immediately in it and then says, well, there'll be some stuff about how other cities aren't as good, and then Carolina, and you go, you're not selling it. He's such a bad salesman of his own song. And George and Paul are kind of, George especially, is joining in and saying, well, it might be jolly, and there's nothing to stop that being Ringo's song on there. Yeah. George is always behind Ringo in the way that Ringo's always behind George. It's really nice to see them. He always supports his songwriting. It's gorgeous.
For his whole life.
Yeah, it's lovely. Yeah, that's another real friendship, which is almost wordless in this. It's just done in that when Ringo starts playing his quite basic song, especially as George is about to hit standards of songwriting that are just way outside Ringo's reach, George backs him up. George will help him write Octopus's Garden later on. He will stand up for his friend because this is a gang and they all get to write songs. It's lovely.
Yeah. And a bit of interplay between Michael Lindsay Hogg and the boys, and Paul saying they want proper consoles. They don't want 4-track. And Paul's saying, well, I know the Beach Boys have got 8-track.
Yeah.
And Michael's like, well, they're American. And, you know?
Yeah, but also George's slightly cynical thing of saying, we underwrite. EMI could get us this kit.
Yeah.
Fund this.
Yeah.
They're aware that as the pop act, they're funding Benjamin Britten getting 8-track. And there's a little bit of, hang on, and there's a lovely, I was talking about this on Twitter with some people, there's a lovely interplay between how important the Beatles are, how significant they are, what a massive band they are, and how shit all their kit is. The kit is diabolical because this is before rock. And you realise when George gets electrocuted by a microphone, or I just say, has no one got a proper bass guitar? This is the biggest entertainment event of the year, and they haven't brought a proper bass guitar. They've got Paul's little sort of schoolboy Hofner, which he's done for nostalgic reasons. He's got a broken Rickenbacker with a fuck nut. Everyone's just playing on a Fender 6. It's not even a proper bass guitar. There's no kit, no gear. This isn't what would happen with Wings, where you're a stadium rock band. And they're slightly jealous. They talk about it later on, that the other bands have come so far from the Cavern, 4 guys and 4 Vox amps. They've got all the, as John Lennon said, the phasers on stage, that what will eventually become the paraphernalia of being a rock band. The Beatles haven't got any of that. They're still got school chairs with Vox amps on them, even when they get up on the roof. I was, as someone who's been in a band and likes kit, I was watching it going, this kit is diabolical. And you suddenly understand why they were so in love with the idea of Magic Alex fixing it all. He's proposing bringing them kit, and it's going, well, can we just have some stuff that works? The fantasy is, we're the biggest band in the world. Surely we should have 8 tracks of recording equipment or microphones that don't electrocute you, or whatever those microphones are they sing into, the little ones on the, the coat hangers with a little blob on the end of them. You go, this kit is school band grade. It's so... And it's not that it's shit. It's not that it's cheap. It's just that there wasn't the kit. This is the band who play Shea Stadium through a the baseball tannoy. It's they're used to crap. They're used to sounding terrible. And they're getting jealous of the Beach Boys' smoothness and the richness of the amount of money that's being spent on the Everlys and people like that. They're getting jealous of it.
And understandably. I mean, what more do they need to prove to EMI, really?
Yeah, and I like the bitterness in George just saying, we pay for this shit. Why haven't we got it? And they moan about, in one of the other episodes, about not being able to get the gear from people. They're thinking, it seems unthinkable this was an era when Fender wouldn't send them some stuff.
Yeah. And then we come to a bit, which blows my socks off, really, where they play a load of old Lennon-McCartney songs from the 50s and 60s. And they're word perfect. And then start with Just Fun.
Yeah. They've got a load of stuff in their back pocket. Peter Jackson edits in some lovely old black and white photos of them playing together as teenagers. They're word perfect on these because these are really simple songs. They're the kind of songs they were writing at the beginning, which once you'd heard them once, you'd remember them forever. There's nothing complicated in it. So John, with his modern head on, goes, I might rewrite the lyrics to One After 909. And then Macca just and Georgia just repeat the words because they're word perfect on them, because they heard them once in 1959 and remembered them word for word, because there's a simplicity to it that has been complicated by the post-Dylan move towards complicated lyrics. But these are folk songs. They're songs they wrote as teenagers. And what they're trying to do, I was watching it because there's Macca with his crappy little Hofner bass and things. They're trying to remember why they're doing this, why they did it in the first place, and what those songs were they wrote in their bedrooms in Liverpool. They were unobserved. They were unconsidered. They weren't for public consumption almost. They were just meant to be belted out at school fetes. They want to be unselfconscious again. But they can't be unselfconscious because in order to be unselfconscious, they booked a film crew to watch them. And it's suddenly obvious that that's the mistake. So they're trying. So they reach back to the most unselfconscious songs they can find, which are ones they wrote when they were teenagers. And they're trying to find it within them. And I think that's a beautiful thing, because I think one of the... There's a great thing in... I mean, they're not even that old. They're not even 30. But there's a feeling of them being older and trying to recapture something. And what's lovely, I think, about some of the material that comes out around this time is that it's got the sophistication of older songwriters, but they're trying to get back to what made them excited about rock in the first place. So that's where you get Oh Darling and Get Back and Come Together. You get them remembering the inner teenager. They're trying to get that person. They're trying to get that person back. They're trying to, and the easiest way to do that is to do, let's do the gawkiest, most embarrassing songs from our back catalogue. That they're laughing at while they're performing them, but they're so unselfconscious. It's almost as that's the only thing they can do to counterbalance how self-conscious they feel in Twickenham with Michael Lindsay Hogg watching them with his big fucking cigar. he couldn't look more like a cartoon of someone from the music business. I mean, it looks like a Louis Bunce.
He is Louis Bunce.
Appalling. Yeah, feeling of going, and obviously he isn't. He's their age, and he's the Rolling Stones guy. He's funky. They're surrounded by these funky people, but weirdly they still feel like they're the man. And again, I suppose you realise how much defence they got from having their guy, from having Epstein, between them and those guys, because he was on their side, even though he was the suit. Yeah, it's funny watching the music industry people round them and realising that they are voluntarily trapped in a world where those people are watching them very closely, because this is a big project and there's a lot of money at stake, but they're trying to play Thinking of Linking to try and remind them of when they didn't have those people looking over their shoulder.
Yeah, we also hear a song called Won't You Please Say Goodbye and one called Because I Know You Love Me So, which is genuinely, I think, a really good song. It's got Everly Brothers harmonies on it and it's very early Beatle lyrics. So should have read your letter and then I'd know. I would have felt much better because I know you love me so. So it is really corny, but the harmonies, and they remember it.
I did think I'd liked... It's remembering the harmonies, is because they, again, I suppose they're also going back to when they were rehearsing a lot. And one of the things that Macca was saying on the 1-2-3, the Apple documentary did with Rick Rubin, that I found really exciting, and is probably key to understanding the Beatles, and also understanding why this is a terrible idea for a project, is the Beatles didn't rehearse very much. As in, they said, we do like a day's rehearsal for a big tour. They're not a hard working rehearsed band. When they're in Hamburg, they're doing new songs every day. They're very restless. What makes the Beatles really interesting is they're not Macca's thing. They're not a tight little band. They're an ideas band. They're constantly coming up with new stuff. But I bet you they can remember all these songs because this is when they used to rehearse.
Yeah.
And they probably haven't, not only have they not played, when everyone says, oh, it's really exciting, the Beatles haven't played live for years, and you're, well, that means they haven't rehearsed for years. They haven't got together and done the songs over and over again. But what the Beatles hate by this point, and why they're a great band once they go back to the studio, is they've not done anything iterative. They've not done anything by repetition. They've not done the same song over and over and over again until they're bored of it. In fact, legendarily, it nearly breaks them during the White Album when they have to do Obladi Oblada over and over again. They all go, we didn't get in a band to do this. This is so boring. This is what you do as a tea room orchestra, as a covers band. You learn it again and again. We're the fucking Beatles. We play this thing twice. George records it, picks the best take, and we go. So they're kind of they've learned that their restlessness is better served by not doing what they're currently doing, but they're remembering back to a time when they used to rehearse and these songs they know off by heart because, and also I suppose as well because it was about 3 weeks ago. You forget that 1962 would have been is not very long ago. It's perfectly possible to remember a load of songs from 6 years ago, even though it feels like it's decades back. But that, yeah, it's interesting they reached back for these songs because this is when they were really shit hot.
Definitely, yeah.
I did think as well that I'd really like to form a covers band that just did pre-1962 Beatles songs.
Yeah. Oh, there's
a great set. I went to, I was lucky enough, I was at a really nice wedding. I went to Kevin Eldon's wedding and he had a scratch band at his wedding, which he played with. And they did Leave My Kitten Alone. And basically, it was basically for the real heads. They just did really raucous rock and roll covers of songs only real Beatles heads know. It was great. It was a proper treat. It was done for I imagine Kev's own pleasure to go, right, what's the best Beatles set list? Well, it would all be from before 1962. Yeah, someone should do this. Form a covers band and just do Thinking of Linking.
Do it. So yeah, so they're still going through these old songs and then they come across One After 909 and it sounds great because they are, like you say before that, they're kind of giggling away and, oh, look how silly this one is. And you can see they're thinking, actually, yeah, we might be able to do something with this.
Yeah, I mean, One After 909 is a fucking great rock song. And part of it, I suppose, is because you know it because it's on Let It Be. So you've heard it since you were a kid. But it's a really good garage rock number. Mm. And remains so. If you're a school band, do One After 909. It's just easy to play and it's really catchy and it's good. Yeah, and it's got the essence of why they're in a band. So they've sort of, this sort of silly exercise of playing songs from their childhoods turns up something which is great and is exactly what they're looking for. This is them getting back. Mm. And it's no coincidence they find this one and then within a few days, Paul's writing Get Back, which is in the similar key, a little shuffle boogie rock number. As in, yeah, that's exactly where you should be. There's no point putting I Am the Walrus on this. You want to be doing these. This is your intention.
Yeah, definitely. I also love the way they use their guitar strings as cocktail sticks with their cigarettes.
And that's a great moment. It's watching where the fags go. At the beginning, it says, like, warning says, warning contains depictions of tobacco. What it doesn't say is contains excellent depictions of tobacco that will persuade you should take up smoking because they're just cool. I'm sorry, it's really annoying. The cigars, everything just looks fucking cool. Contains persuasive depictions of tobacco, which will ruin your child.
Just say no, kids. And again, they're supposed to be, you know, there's a lot of faffing. You would have thought, right, they would have started a song now, but no, then they're sort of messing around with Obladi Oblada.
But again, this is the reality of this. Yeah. And I think watching this longer, I couldn't understand watching Let It Be as a kid why they were so miserable. Because they finished the White Album 6 weeks earlier. They should be on a high, but they're absolutely broken and miserable and empty. Whereas if you watch the extended version, watch Get Back, what's happening? They're not miserable. This is really hard, what they're trying to do. While someone's watching you, become creative. And it's not that they haven't performed live for X years. They haven't rehearsed for X years. They haven't been in a room together. There's a lot of human interaction and whose song do we do? The moment you say you're going to do George's song or John's song or Paul's song, that's a power grab. This is awkward. This is socially awkward. Normally, certainly the White Album, they were in working on each other's songs when they were in the mood for it. No one had said sit down and rehearse. And rehearsing in a band is boring. And that they're aware of that, I think. And they think that this will make terrible television. So they try and avoid starting a song. And they do Obladi Oblada, which I learned as a Beatles fan was an absolute no-no that none of them ever did. Mm. But they they remember it, and John's laughing at it. They appear to be enjoying taking the piss out of it. But again, that's the song they rehearsed to death. So again, that's probably one of the last songs they have rehearsed as a band that they can actually play.
Yeah.
They're not going to sit down and do She Said, She Said. They've never rehearsed that. That's not a song they know.
Well, they're not going to
do... but they're not going to do... He does I'm So Tired later on, which is really charming. They do know each other's songs a bit, but they're not going to sit down and do Only a Northern Song because they've never played that together. They're going to play the few songs they know together, which is old ones and ones they probably got bored with in the studio, being forced to over-rehearse.
Yeah, yeah. I do love John's rewording of this. Desmond had a barrel in Marketplace. Doris had another in the bum. Charlie had another in his bag of tub. And lordy, lordy, did they have a bag of fun. Which is genius, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I think that... But there's no malice in it. And I think that you've got used to the story being that they're so fed up with Paul's bloody la-di-da songs. And of course, I grew up knowing that you weren't supposed to like Paul because he's la-di-da and Lennon objected to it. They're all having a really good time. They're all enjoying each other's idioms.
Yeah.
It's really funny. And no one appears to... I'm sure Paul is holding in a bit of hurt that John's rewriting his song, but it's his mate, so he doesn't care. He's allowed to take the piss out of him. It's fine.
More... messing around, Midnight Special. What do you want to make those eyes at me for? And then the Third Man theme, the Harry Lime theme.
Yeah.
Which is really good.
Things they know. Yeah, it's lovely. Oh, this is the start when you start to realise that a lot of the time you thought that was George on recordings and bootlegs. It's John. John is bothered with learning guitar parts, something I never thought, I thought he had no interest in. He seems so apathetic in Let It Be. It's interesting to see him playing a bit of quite nice shadowsy lead guitar. It's good.
Yeah. And this is another one they used to play back in the cavern in Hamburg.
They're doing exactly the right thing. I think when I used to hear these bootlegs and go, oh, they're just arsing about. But now watching it in context, you go, no, they're doing exactly what they should be doing. They're trying to remember what it was like to be a band and play together. So a lot of this old stuff needs to be there. They're trying to create an atmosphere. There's no atmosphere in the room. There's no atmosphere in the studio. They're trying to create an atmosphere within that tiny bit of carpet between the four of them, like an abstract space in their minds where they can remember why the hell they're doing this.
So then we get the electric shock moment, George on his microphone. George is pretty sadistic with this, isn't he? He's basically telling the sound engineer, you get an electric shock too. And he's not happy until he does.
Your turn. If this boy dies, which is a lovely line. I've a macker just if again, the they're looking after each other, they're joking with each other, they're in character, they're messing about. But also, this is another reveal that the kit's a bit shit. This is the best. This is why Magic Alex has got an open goal, because all their shit's wired up badly. And people wouldn't know this stuff until the 70s rock touring thing took over. People didn't know about electrical safety. That's what Van Halen's M&M's thing is about. You know that the legendary story that Van Halen's rider said it had to have M&M's, a bowl of M&M's in Van Halen's dressing room with all the blue M&M's taken out. And what it was a test to see whether you'd read all the electrical specs on their rider as well. And if you got into a place that had the blue M&M's still in the bowl, it meant you hadn't read the rider and the specs, and David Lee Roth might get electrocuted on stage because they played some pretty bad dive bars. And it was a way of a canary in the coal mine to say, have you read our electrical specs? Because right into the 70s, there was a risk of bands electrocuting themselves on badly wired up kit. And here you get to watch George, again, making the entertainment product of the year, get electrocuted because people have only been wiring bands up for about 10 minutes and no one really knows what they're doing.
So then they start doing some proper work. And it's I've Got a Feeling, and they're working on the bridge. And there's a bit of, clearly, it's too high for John. Paul wants John to sing a particular harmony. Clearly, it's too high. But Paul, no, then you sing this.
Pushing him harder. It's also, it's in Macca's Little Richard voice, isn't it, that only he can do. It's the high rock and roll rasp thing. I love this little sequence, because when you know songs really well, you tend to assume that they just, especially with brilliant songwriters, they just tumbled out of them. And this is them finding out, okay, I can't do a harmony. We can't do a duet on this. The version you know, which sounds quite raucous, isn't as raucous as it could be. And also, the real joy of this, if people who aren't in bands, this is the way songs are written. People do what a songwriter friend of mine used to call singing in Norwegian, where you just go, it's the shape of the vowels and the shape of the things. And you'll only nail it down much, much later. And this is lovely to watch, because I assume this is how the Beatles worked, because one of the reasons they're the best songwriters of their era, is they were always attentive to the vowel sounds and the consonant sounds so that the words sound natural. They're not Dylan-ish, they're not clever necessarily all the time, but they always sound like inevitable words. And this is Paul's going, that's that Dylan, and you go, right, that's gibberish, but I know the sentiment of what he's singing. He's going to roar and it's going to end up with a, that looks like you, it's going to have you at the end of it, but the rest of it is just little tiny pins in the map of where the words are going to be. And it's just the sentiment. And then they'll fill that, they'll colour it in within those lines later. But it's lovely to watch it happening, because I think that's a lot of songwriters work that way. And when you hear, it's always nice to hear a Beatles demo, because very often it's just gibberish.
Mm.
Sometimes it's gibberish right to the end, but they're only concerned with the sound and the feel and the texture of words as sort of dreamlike poetry, not in taking a poem that John has written and then setting it to music. And I think that's why their stuff's catchy, because you can sing it along, that you never find your tongue caught on something. And very rarely with a Beatles song do you not know what the words are after the first listen. It's very rare that you have to look up all the words. People, they're a sing-along band, they're designed for cavern consumption, and they're still working that way. They're concerned with, which is why Paul will write in Live and Let Die, this ever-changing world in which we're living, and I know it's in which we live in, but you can bet the dummy version of it was this ever-changing world in which we live in, and was wrong. But he then fudges it to fix it, because they're all fixes of abstract word shapes. They're not lyrics that were written down on a piece of paper first. Mal writes down with a biro what he hears them sing. And that's, again, it's folk music. That's a very pure way of doing it. And it's why I think some bands that I don't like as much as the Beatles, I can hear they've written all the words down first and then forced them with a crowbar to fit. I love the way the Beatles are always about organic sounds. And it kind of works. It's the same way as ABBA writing their second language. They're just about the sound of the words. It's lovely. It gives it a great natural organic feel. And you get a chance to hear Paul doing it here as much as you do with Get Back later.
Yeah. Because I think it's on Get Back where he uses the word. Yeah, they need, the words need to be sharper, and he can visualise.
You know, where there are words you can't use. There are vowel sounds you can't use. You need to leave syllables open or closed or small or what. You get a feeling of that. And when they do Give Me Some Truth next with John, John's doing the same thing, finding his way through. Dabba navas dabba dabba diddle dabba dabba. It's just okay. It'll fit over here, and after a while, this will. Like a natural process of erosion will shape this into a song, but we're going to let it go. And actually, the fascinating things about Get Back coming out, because I was in a band and have written songs and things like that, is non-band people going, oh, is that how it works? And you go, yeah, that's how it works. It's you're seeing, but people kept going, we're seeing songwriting. And you went, well, most of the time you're not, you're seeing rehearsal. But there are a few moments in Get Back, I mean, it's precious few. They normally bring the songs from home. They've written them at home.
Yeah.
So you very rarely see the moment of creation. Get Back to the exception where I haven't got so excited. But I bet you Paul had that riff a little bit. But they bring you stuff from home. But this is another chance to see the process of shaping a song, which there's not as much of in this documentary as you think. You get to see a lot of rehearsal and a lot of band dynamic. You don't see a lot of songwriting, but this is a lovely little bit of you're watching some songs be written, including Give Me Some Truth. Who was expecting that to pop up? It's great.
And again, it's the relationships between everybody. So Mal Evans, obviously, writing out the lyrics. That's his role. And
the secretary.
Amongst everything else. And give me some truth. It's that juxtaposition of knowing that it's not going to be released till everything's finished. And here they are as a band doing it. And it's got that no freaked out, yellow-bellied son of Gary Cooper gonna. Exactly what you're saying, just throwing out the words.
And isn't that going to be... That's going to be tricky dicky by the time it comes out, because basically this predates Watergate. So weirdly, history's going to infect it. And also that lovely phrase that Paul or John says, well, that song we were working on.
Yes.
Now I think of Give Me Some Truth as an archetypal Lennon solo song, but it's something they were helping each other with back in the day. And also this is whatever we are, weeks, months after Revolution. And you go, oh, it's the same impulse. It's one of John's political songs. This is the other song that goes with the Revolution. It's great. Yeah.
Be interested to know when they worked. So was it something they did during the White Album? Is it something they did in India?
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, it does feel very White Album. It feels like this is going to be from the same impulse that John says, I'm only going to write political songs now. I'm going to do this so it gives you power to the people and this. A little run of... And yeah, also I'd forgotten. It's a great song. It's a really good song. It's good, isn't it? And I didn't think it was part of these sessions. Yeah. It's great.
Then we see the arrival of a lovely Lowry organ, just as George says, I've got a few slow ones, and they do All Things Must Pass.
This is gorgeous. This is so nice. I can recommend, by the way, if you're a musician and have a guitar, to sit with it on your lap like I did, and then George, you can be in the Beatles, because George will tell you the chords. Yeah. And you can play along. It's just what I did. As soon as he said, it starts in E, I grabbed a guitar. Right, George, talk me through. I'm going to be in the Beatles for this. It's good. The chorus is, there's B minor. It's good. It's really, really nice. And you get to watch it, and there is nothing stopping this being on the record.
Mm.
I think this is why George is pissed off, because the band play it beautifully. They've already found a space for it. It's a very, very George song, but there's room for those really George solo album songs in the Beatles. There's nothing apart from he's the little brother and they're ignoring him in a few days that stops this being one of the best performances of the early run. So why doesn't it get on? Why aren't they playing it later? He's self-deprecating, says it's a slow one, but it's All Things Must Pass. It's one of the best slow ones ever. It's beautiful.
And the three-part harmonies during the chorus... they're straight in. They're hearing it for the first time, and they're just like, I think you said before on one of the when we did the Christmas records years ago, about how if one of them starts singing, all of them jump in at thirds. It's like an automatic harmony machine.
Yeah, they know how to do it. And this is you're watching this. This won't be very long. This is one day. This is a tiny slice of one day. So from George saying it's E, F sharp minor, E, A, from that to John picking those out on the organ to them doing harmonies. Looks like it probably takes about 20 minutes. It can't be much longer than that because of the slice of the day you're in. You could record that and put it on the record. It's absolutely fine. The fact they stop doing it is where George's dissatisfaction gets in. And this also gets George engaged even more. He's already been really engaged. He then starts talking about the difference between recording for studio and doing stuff live. He talks about the practicalities of it. Suddenly George is leading the band. Paul, again, it might be the edit, but Paul sits back, barely says anything. John just smiles at him. George talks about what they're doing, the project, how it's going to be, how he's wary about the difference between studio and live, but also really excited about it. And they start talking about overdubs. He's producing the record and things. He's totally engaged because they've taken him seriously and his song's lovely.
Yeah. There are, throughout all of this, bear in mind there's double the audio that there is the footage. So it may well be... There's a few bits of editing I've noticed that could change the story. Not hugely, but just, you know, a slight raised eyebrow could change the whole story. So, yeah, you have to take it with it. I think if you can't see them talking, often it might not be the footage. Don't know, though.
Yeah, they're finding a story within this, but the next bit of the story is a lot of very, as told in this documentary, is a lot of very engaged chat led by George off the back of playing All Things Must Pass. And he's talking about something, again, which I think maybe something if you've been in a band you'll appreciate more than if you haven't, which is that when they're making the White Album and they're a studio band, they're a studio band as they could possibly be as, and they're coming in separately, they're overdubbing parts. They'll only have to play each part once, maybe twice, or get it right. And then they go bang, and they never have to play it again. George will learn a guitar solo, play it once, it'll be absolutely perfect, and he can put that in a drawer. They're never going to play it live. He will never have to learn what he did. He can explore and find his way through. That's a very different process than what they're doing here, which is attempting to develop parts, learn them while the other guys are also developing parts at the same time, remember them, and then learn them for a live performance. And George is, obviously, he says he's excited. He's nervous about that, which is why within minutes he's talking about what a great guitarist Clapton is, because he's feeling, shit, what if I can't do this anymore? I'm not a great solo guitarist. I'm not a great improviser. What if on the last three or four records we made, all that great playing I did was just because we were in the studio and I was on my own and had time to think? What if I'm not very good at learning impressive parts to play live in a world that's changing and is getting into prog rock and experimental rock and jazz rock and things? I can't do that. I'm a cavern guitarist. And he's expressing insecurity about his ability to play because rehearsing to do a gig or a TV special is different than going into Abbey Road and recording eight bars of guitar.
Yeah,
he's feeling exposed, and it's quite touching. But I think he's the only one who's saying, Paul's going, hey, it's great, we're a great little band, this is going to be so easy because we were a great little band, so we'll be a great little band again. And George is going, but we're a different band now. We go in and do eight bars over and over again till we get it right. And then we forget it. which is why we can't play, why none of us are playing any of the songs off the last few albums as warm-up, because we don't know them.
Yeah. It's interesting, he's saying, you know, I'm the guitarist, I'll come up with bits like in Help. He'll come up with those beautiful little moments, but he was saying, you know, he's a different guitarist to Eric. And I'm wondering, but he's sort of, he's saying, yeah, I'm getting there now. And it's, I think maybe that's why he wants to have more time to go over and over again to learn his what he's going to do. Whereas Paul wants to say, no, do that, and then let's move on.
Well, they're a restless band. I think that's what's interesting. I think Paul as well has traditionally been the person who goes back and does his bass parts again and again and again. He's the last overdub very often, just because where bass sits in the recording. He gets ages in the studio to finish things off and to get them right, which is a real bass player's privilege, and he's a planner and a Brian Wilson-y kind of arranger of things. I think they're aware, George is more aware than anyone, that this is a different thing for them to do. And I think John here is the linchpin of the Beatles are restless. They're an ideas band. The thing John doesn't want to do is play the same thing over and over and over again, hence moaning about obla-di obla-da. George is saying, yeah, but we're going to have to learn the same thing over and over again. And Paul's just going, but everyone loves doing that, don't they? And you kind of want to go, that's the dynamic. And Ringo's going, Ringo's weird, I will play whatever you want to play. Ringo will sit there and go, as long as I get to play, I'm happy.
Yeah.
But he's the live guy. It's interesting watching that dynamic play out. And I think that Paul hasn't understood that this is a different thing, as in it will leave George exposed. George will be nervous. He's got Hendrix is in town and Clapton's around. He's not that guy. Lennon's going, but I've got 7 new songs to do. I don't want to do this one now, I'm bored. Macca's going, we'll do 48 takes of Maxwell's Silver Hammer until we get this right. This kind of suits Macca. Weirdly, you get the feeling this is what he's always wanted the band to be. As in, we just practice and practice and practice. We're Sgt. Pepper's band. We practice and practice and practice. And then we go out and we put on the best show in the world. It'll be as good as the Bruce McMouse show. It's going to be amazing. He's got these grand plans that they're a perfect tea room orchestra. They're the David Frost band. And the other band, Lennon's kind of going, yeah, to a certain extent. And Harrison is very wisely saying, that's asking something very different of us than we've done for 4 years. Yeah. And I love... even though it might be an editing thing, I love his awareness of it and his sophistication, his understanding, his producers. Everyone takes turns to be the band's manager. And for a minute here, George is the manager and goes, we've got to be worried about this. How will this look? And Macca's going, oh, but all that Clapton stuff's just jazz. I don't like that. So forget that. Don't worry about it. You're going, yeah, he's right to be worried about it. The world's changed.
Yeah. Talking of jazz, the bit of conversation they have, and we first hear the first mention of Billy Preston. His ears must have been burning that day.
Peter Jackson must have. Oh, also Peter Jackson must have gone, we get prefiguring. I mean, maybe he edited this in from a conversation done in 1974, but it's so perfect. It's so that they go, who's the best guy you know? And Harrison just waxes lyrical about the guy who is going to be. It's like, this is pure Hollywood screenplay structuring. This is. I remember talking about this, about how Marvel movies work. They borrow this from comics, is splash pages. People talk about, there's a guy, he's going to come, he's going to kill you. And at some point, someone steps through a door full of dry ice and they go, waiting for me? This is superhero structuring. Later on, the guy they've described as super organist is going to step through a thing like a tag team wrestling thing and go, looking for an organist? It's set up for that to really pay off later on. And at some point, the mask will come off and underneath they go, oh, Billy Preston, it's going to happen. It's brilliant.
Oh, I love him. And it ends on a, I think it's, again, edited to sort of imply the first signs of fatigue, but Paul sings, I'm so tired.
Yeah, which is, I mean, aren't they supposed to have, the story we've heard is they resent each other doing the songs on their own, they're not involved in, but Paul likes that song. And has learned it. There's no reason. I don't know. Does he play on? I just assumed all the White Album songs, people weren't playing each other's songs. I know it's not true, but that's the impression you've got. But it's lovely hearing Paul do I'm So Tired. It's great. And they're talking about sort of, this comes out of a discussion that George, again, leading, managing, running the band, says, are we going to do any oldies but goldies? Are we going to do any old stuff? And obviously the answer is, we're really rusty. We haven't rehearsed for ages. We don't necessarily know the old stuff. So they reach for some old stuff, and they talk about. John says, "I'd like to do Help," which is, do you think, great? I want to know what John's great new version of Help is that he had in '69. And then George plays Every Little Thing. and they all start joining in on that. A lovely version. Which is a great
that would
song.
Have been
I mean, imagine that would
brilliant
have been great
if
live.
They'd finished that.
But he's saying, should we do some old songs before Paul says, I'm so tired, which is a nice drop in for the story of the whole the Get Back project. That's great. But this comes out, are we going to play any old songs? What old songs would we play? And George, quite rightly, says something to them, which is advice that bands should understand. The advice Adamant didn't follow for Live Aid. Don't play all the new songs off the new LP. The audience will resent it. And George is saying, do we want to get people on side by playing a couple of hits? Do we want to do Twist and Shout and then do the new songs? And that's someone who is, despite the stories that were in Let It Be, and I learned growing up about the Beatles, this is George completely engaged as a realist, practical, understanding the audience, understanding the band and their role and what they've got to do. And he's saying, should we do some old ones? And then a lovely edit to the old one, in inverted commas, they choose to do from last year, is Paul saying, I'm knackered. That's the song they end up playing together. I mean, these documentaries are masterpieces of pulling story out of almost nothing. And that's a great bit of that. It's a documentarian's art, that. But yeah, they do play an oldie, and it's not one you expect. And it says they're tired.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
And I also love that, you know, it's been preceded by two songs that would be on solo Beatle albums. So, you know, these songs will never get done for the project. Yeah. And the band have got to split before we get to hear them. Very strange.
Yeah. There's so much story. There's so much story in this. And I think that people have loved this and responded to it so well, because when you lean in to it, there's detail everywhere. I mean, people love being forensic about the Beatles. Hence us having this conversation at all. But it's the excitement of all this new material, this new evidence coming to light, like a big dossier has turned up. Said, look at this. But actually, the stories you draw from it, generally, and God, we've needed it so much this year, how really warm and about support and friendship. And here, this is a lovely, I think this is one of my favourite George days in the whole thing, where you realise that he has got a really good grasp on how difficult the task is and what they might need to do to get over it. And I think the tragedy is they don't listen to him enough.
Yeah. John Morris, thanks so much. If you were Michael Lindsay-Hogg at the end of day two, what would you be thinking?
I'd be thinking, when are they going to talk about Tripoli? Because that's the most important thing. I'd still be banging on about that. I love that. Everyone's really rude about Michael Lindsay-Hogg in this, because he's been reframed to be the baddie. And he isn't the baddie, because otherwise there wouldn't be this footage. He's kind of the hero. But what he's doing is he's taking Beatle Land and asking boringly practical questions of it, which is, are you going to do the thing you promised you're going to do? Which you mustn't ask them, because eventually they'll always not go to Everest and just go to Abbey Road, because it's herding cats. I think it's interesting. I think he would be thinking, this is herding cats. I think he'd be sensitive to the mood in the room as someone who makes documentaries and is a filmmaker and is an observer. He's our fly on the wall. He's given us this footage. And if he's got any sense, he'd go, oh, this is going to be difficult, because they're not a single unit. This isn't like saying to a showbiz. This isn't like saying to Cliff and the Shadows, right, you're going to Birmingham. It's difficult to pull people in a direction when they're four individuals. But I think you'd be hopeful, because I think there's a lot of... This is nowhere near as despairing as day two looked in Let It Be.
Mm-mm.
There appears to be method behind a lot of the madness in it. Why are they playing loads of old songs when they're 15? Because that's the story we're telling. They're trying to get back to being 15. George is talking sensibly. It sounds like they're going to play songs by all of them. You're going to get a bit of Macca and a bit of Lennon and a bit of George. It's all looking quite promising, I think, on day two. This isn't the jolly bit of the story. This is the quite bleak bit. But there's a lot of creativity and happiness on this day, which I think would make you think you've got a good project.
Yeah. John Morris, thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
Oh, it's been lovely to get back and have a look at it again. I might go and look at it again now.